Okay, so factoring. So today we're going to talk about the factoring problem, which is really one of the main applications of quantum computers. It was actually one of the first applications of quantum computers that was discovered, and really provided a lot of the motivation for the field. Actually, not just in terms of the sort of computational stuff that we're talking about now, but some of the information theoretic stuff that we're going to talk about later. I mean, a lot of the interest in these ideas of processing information represented quantum mechanically really came from this original discovery of Shor's algorithm. So it's really an important part of this whole area of quantum information processing, and today we'll finally see some of the details of how this algorithm works. So this is an algorithm for factoring integers, and one of the reasons to be interested in factoring integers has to do with cryptography. So maybe you know that the way, for example, financial transactions are encrypted on the internet, or most transactions are encrypted on the internet, is using this thing called the RSA cryptosystem, which relies on the difficulty of factoring. So actually, one of the things that I want to tell you about today is how this RSA cryptosystem works and how it's related to this factoring problem. Okay, so are there any questions from last time? So last time we talked about phase estimation. We saw this algorithm for estimating eigenvalues of unitary operators given eigenvectors, and we're going to use that as a crucial component of Shor's algorithm. So if there are any remaining questions about that, actually, this would be a good time to ask. I guess you saw in the tutorial how you would do phase estimation when you weren't given this promise that the phase was an exact n-bit binary fraction. So we will actually need that in Shor's algorithm. Okay, all right, so let's get started. So so factoring is just a basic computational problem. So it's the following problem. So we're going to be given some integer n. Well, I guess it's a positive integer. And what we would like to do is, find some distinct primes, p1 through pk, and some, positive integers, let's say e1 through ek, so that n is just the product of these primes to these powers. So it's p1 to the e1, et cetera, times pk to the ek. Okay, so this is just the factorization of an integer into a product of primes. And this factorization is unique. So this is a kind of basic factor number theory, that if you require the factors to be prime numbers, there's only one way to break down a given integer into a product of primes. Okay, so now we could be specified, to make this into a computational problem, we could specify this integer n using some string of bits. We would need about the log of capital N bits to specify what that integer is. And then we might want to actually output what the primes are that appear in its factorization, and what the powers are, e1 through ek. And of course, if we're given some algorithm which will just find some non-trivial factor of a composite number n, that's enough to be able to factor, because if we could peel off one factor from n, then we break the problem down into some smaller parts. If we write n equals m times l, then where neither m or l is 1, then we can just now factor m and l, and those are smaller integers, so it's sufficient to actually just be able to find some efficient algorithm to break n into some product of factors of non-trivial factors, and if we can do that, that's enough to have an algorithm for factoring. Okay, but actually nobody knows an efficient algorithm for factoring. So, although this is a problem which has been studied for a very long time, right? So certainly it's been, studied, people have thought seriously about these kinds of questions in number theory for hundreds of years. Nobody knows a polynomial time procedure which will factorize some arbitrary given integer n. So it seems like a hard problem for a classical computer. And because of that hardness, that presumed hardness, people have tried to come up with cryptosystems, and this RSA cryptosystem is the most famous example, that exploit this idea that maybe factoring is hard. Of course, we don't have a proof that factoring is hard. If we could prove that that factoring is hard, that would show that P doesn't equal NP, and this is, this major open question. So factoring is not thought to be NP complete, but it is a problem in NP if you make up some decision version of it. So certainly if you could prove that problem is hard, you would show there's something in NP that's outside of P. So probably proving that factoring is hard is beyond the reach of what we know how to do now. But we, on the other hand, we sort of plausibly think that it's hard because people have been thinking about it for hundreds of years, and still we don't have an algorithm. As far as anyone knows, you know, maybe someone at the NSA has an algorithm and they're just not telling, but it seems unlikely. Yeah, did you have a question?
In this case, when you say hard, precisely what do you mean?
So by hard, I mean, you know, that there isn't a polynomial time algorithm. That's what I would mean by hard. So, you know, that the best known algorithm takes super polynomial time. Actually, there are algorithms for factoring which take less than exponential time, and this is one of the reasons that we think factoring is probably not NP-complete. Because, you know, we sort of think that NP-complete problems probably really take exponential time. Although, again, that's the kind of thing we don't know how to prove. Okay, so you know, if there's no really fast algorithm for factoring, then maybe we can, you know, turn those lemons into lemonade and, you know, do something with the assumption that factoring is hard. And RSA is exactly that. It's an encryption scheme which relies on the assumption that the factoring problem is hard.
Yes. Would it mean that if you would prove P equal NP, then there is no such thing as RSA possible anymore?
If you would prove that P equals NP, then certainly RSA would not be secure, right? So if P equals NP, then you can factor in polynomial time.
So then, and there can be no similar algorithm, right? Because anything that you can check easily would be crackable easily.
That's right. Oh. That's right, yeah. But probably P doesn't equal NP, so you don't need to worry about that, I think. I mean... You know, it is a logical possibility, though. Yeah, I mean, there are interesting questions about whether you can still do cryptography, you know, in various complexity theoretic scenarios, but yeah, it's a good point. Okay, so let's assume that factoring is hard. I mean, we'll see that actually that assumption breaks if we can build a quantum computer. That's, you know, going to be what most of the lecture is about, but let's, you know, first just see what we could get if it were actually the case that factoring were hard, and people believe this, you know, people believe that factoring is hard so strongly that, you know, much of the cryptography that we use today is based on this assumption, right? So when you buy something on the internet, you know, the cryptography is based on this assumption that factoring is hard, and, you know, so someone at least believes this assumption pretty strongly. Okay, so here's RSA. So the idea of this, you know, this encryption scheme is that we want to be able to somehow create a system where anyone who wants to can send us a message, you know, in some secure way, so that an eavesdropper can't tell what the contents of the message are. So let's, you know, imagine just to be concrete. So we're Alice, and Alice would like Bob to be able to send her, you know, messages securely. Now, there's another problem here that you might worry about, which is, you know, how does Alice know actually that it's Bob that's sending her the message? And that's a separate problem. So that's called authentication, and that's something we're not going to think about now. So actually, this will be a protocol where anyone can send Alice messages securely, and there's not a mechanism in the protocol, as I'll describe it, to ensure that it's a particular person who's actually sending the messages. So you might separately have to worry about this kind of authentication problem. This actually will allow Bob or anyone else to send Alice a message securely. And, you know, you would like to maybe also have some kind of a signature scheme that you could use to tell that it was really, say, Bob or Charlie or some other particular person who's sending the message. Okay. Well, let's not worry about this authentication. Okay. So there's a particular protocol for doing this, which has three stages. So there's going to be a key generation stage, an encryption stage, and a decryption stage. So first, you know, Alice is going to generate a key, and actually the key will have two parts. There'll be a public part and a private part. So the public part is used to encrypt messages, and the private part is used to decrypt messages. And the idea is that, you know, Alice will make the public part public, so she'll, you know, publish it in the newspaper or something, so that Bob or anyone else has the ability to encrypt messages, and the private key will be used in the decryption. So it's very important that that remains secret. Okay, so the first part is this key generation phase. And so, okay, this is going to have something to do with factorization. So the first thing that Alice is going to do is she's going to pick a product of two large prime numbers. Okay, so Alice picks prime numbers, P and Q, and, you know, they should be large and she should choose them at random. It shouldn't be easy to guess what prime numbers P and Q Alice is picking. Now, you could worry about, you know, how can she actually do this efficiently? Of course, it's going to be important that these parts of the protocol can be done efficiently, and, you know, you can show that you can do this. I mean, one way you can do this is just to choose you know, kind of large numbers at random and then check whether they're prime, which is something you can do efficiently. And, you know, there are, of course, if you pick a random number, it's probably not prime, but the density of primes is not so bad that you don't, you know, occasionally find one. You know, you can think about other mechanisms for generating prime numbers. This would take us too far afield right now, but certainly the question of, you know, how you actually come up with these things is something you have to think about if you want to implement the protocol. Okay, so Alice picks prime numbers P and Q, and we're going to let N be the product of P and Q. Okay, so, you know, the idea at this point is, well, maybe P and Q should be some kind of private information. This won't be exactly the public key, but certainly P and Q, sorry, this won't be exactly the private key, but P and Q should be kept private, certainly. And on the other hand, N is the kind of thing that maybe it's acceptable to distribute publicly because we think that factoring is hard. So we think that if you're given N, it won't necessarily be easy to come up with the numbers P and Q, you know, if the numbers are big enough. Okay, and then, you know, so she picks these prime numbers P and Q, and then another thing which is going to be relevant is what's called phi of N. So phi of N is what's called the Euler-Totient function of N. So this is the number of positive integers less than N that are relatively prime to N. Okay, so, you know, that have no common factors with N. And, you know, it's kind of a basic factor of number theory that if P and Q are distinct primes, I guess I should have said that these are distinct primes. It's important that this is just not a prime squared. Then phi of N will be P minus 1 times Q minus 1. Yes? The Euler-Totient function. This is the word.
And before you wrote down the formula, you said some other description of precisely what it
is. Yeah, so this is the number of positive integers less than n that share no common factors with n. So this is the you know number of positive integers. And N that share no common factors with it. Okay. So now, this is N, and this is phi of N, and both of these actually will be used as the modulus for some kind of calculations. So we'll do some calculations modulo N, and we'll do some calculations modulo phi of N. And we'll have to be a little bit careful about keeping these two things separate. Okay, so this is just kind of some kind of setup. And then what Alice needs to do next is she needs to come up with an encryption key. And so what she's going to do is she's going to pick, you know, probably in some kind of random way, she's going to pick some number E. So E is going to be, I guess, at most 5n, and it's going to be something which is relatively prime to phi of n. So E with, it shouldn't be 1 probably, so E should be between 2 and phi of n minus 1, and the GCD of E and phi of n should be 1. So this is the same thing as saying that E and phi of n have no common factors. So this is the greatest common divisor function. Some of these, you know, there'll be a bit of number theory in what we're doing now, and if some of these terms aren't completely familiar to you, it's probably okay if you just kind of get the impression of, you know, how the scheme works. Okay, and now this is going to be the encryption key. So while the encryption key is going to be E and also N, it's going to be important to know what N is as well in order to be able to do encryption. And then there also will have to be a decryption key. And it's the following thing. So Alice is going to compute D to be the inverse of E modulo phi of N. Or in other words, what I mean by that is that D is the number, you know, between 0 and phi of N minus 1 such that, you know, D times E is equal to 1 mod phi of N. So if I multiply E times D, you know, I get some number which could be bigger than phi of N, but if I reduce it modulo phi of N, I get 1. And, you know, this condition is necessary for such a D to exist, right? So we wouldn't be able to find such a D unless E and phi of N were relatively prime. Okay. So then, you know, now she's finished the key generation phase, but what are the keys? So the public key is E and N. So this is going to be used to do encryption, and the idea is that encryption should be something that anyone can do. So this can be made public. And the private key is D of N. So this is used for encryption. And this is used for decryption. So now, if you believe that you actually need to have the key in order to do decryption efficiently, then anyone can encrypt a message, but only Alice can decrypt a message that was sent to her because only she knows what D is. Right? Okay. So, this stuff can be done efficiently. So, Alice can also pick this E efficiently, and then D can be computed efficiently because if you know what N is, then you know what phi of N is, because that's easy to compute. If you know what P and Q are, then you know what phi of N is. If you just know what N is and you don't know what phi of N is, then it may be hard to do this, and the assumption actually is that it is hard to do this. But if you know P and Q, then you know phi of N, so then you can use the Euclidean algorithm to compute what D is. So there's this algorithm called Euclid's algorithm that you can use, which will allow you to rapidly compute modular inverses like this. But if you don't know what phi of N is, then you don't know how to compute the decryption key yourself. And at least one natural strategy for doing that is to factor N into P times Q. But if factoring is actually hard, then you can't do that. So this is kind of what the assumption is for the security of the scheme. Okay, and now I should show you what the other two phases of the protocol are. So then there's the encryption phase. So in the encryption phase, Bob has some message that he wants to encrypt, and we're going to interpret that message as some number modulo n. So Bob has a message m, and let's say that that's an integer modulo n. I mean, if it's a message that takes more than the log of n bits to specify, then he can break it down into pieces and encrypt each of the pieces individually in this way. Okay, but so let's say that his message is an integer modulo n. So what's he going to do? It's very simple. He computes m to the power of the encryption key, and then reduces modulo n. And this is something that can be done efficiently. If you raise to a high power, of course you could get a very big number. But we're only interested in the value modulo n. And there's sort of a repeated squaring technique that he can use in order to do this computation efficiently. Okay. So this is the encryption, and this is going to be called C. So this is the ciphertext. So the idea is that this is something that Bob should feel comfortable. If the protocol is secure, Bob should feel comfortable sending C over some insecure channel, because someone who sees C, unless they know how to, they may know the public key, but unless they have the private key, the assumption is that it will be hard for them to decrypt the message. Okay, so they don't have the private key because Alice, holds on to it. So the idea is that then from C, it's hard to figure out what the message is. Okay, but on the other hand, Alice can easily decrypt. So what does she do? So Alice computes. Can somebody see how you would decrypt if you know what D is? Yeah, exactly, right. So you should take C to the power D. So C to the D mod N. Exactly. And why does that work? Well, this is the same thing as M to the E times D mod N. Okay, but E times D is congruent to 1 modulo phi of n, right? And when we work in the exponent here, when we think about numbers modulo n, well, the exponent will wrap around when we go by phi of n. So this is just a little kind of basic number theory. Although if you haven't seen it before, I'm sure it's a little bit opaque. But so since this E times D is 1 mod phi of n, this will actually just be the same thing as M modulo n. And so when Alice does this computation and reduces modulo n, she gets exactly the message that Bob wanted to send her. Yes? Yeah, so what I mean is this. So, you know, it's a theorem, and you can prove this using something called Fermat's little theorem, that if you take, you know, m to the power of, so, you know, any integer, I don't know, a plus some integer b times phi of n, you know, so if you do anything like this, then this is going to be the same thing as m to the a modulo n. So in other words, if I add any multiple of phi of n in the exponent, that's just going to give me the same thing as if I had, say, b equals 0. So that's what I mean by it wrapping around. Every time you add phi of n in the exponent, you come back to where you started. So maybe it's an exercise to prove this. And if you want to prove this, you want to use something called Fermat's little theorem. Which maybe you have to look up if you haven't seen it before, but it, you know, you can prove this. Okay, so this is how the whole protocol works. And we see that the security of the protocol certainly relies on the assumption that factoring is hard. Because if factoring were easy, then, you know, anyone who knew n could compute the product p times q, and then they know exactly what Alice knew when she was generating things. They know, you know, they know n, they know p and q, they know e, and that's what Alice had at her disposal when she computed the decryption key d. So, you know, so if they would have to do exactly the same amount of work that Alice had to do anyway in generating the key, then, you know, that would if they actually knew what P and Q were because they were able to factor, then the remaining work that they would have to do would be the same work that Alice had to do anyway in key generation. And so they could break the protocol. Okay, but on the other hand, if we think factoring is hard, then certainly that attack doesn't work. And then you might worry, you know, are there other attacks that work? So you can actually prove that if what you want to do is really recover the private key, then that actually is as hard as factoring. So that's something that can be proven. It's conceivable that you could break the protocol actually without reproducing the private key, because you don't necessarily want to learn D. You just want to learn, you know, what the message was corresponding to some particular ciphertext. And that you know, corresponds basically to, like, you know, taking the eth root modulo n. And that's a slightly different problem. And, you know, it could be that you could solve that without having an algorithm to factor. But people suspect that even that problem is hard. So, you know, it's generally believed that this protocol is secure against attacks by classical computers. And, you know, it's, again, it's not the kind of thing that that we know how to prove, but people believe it strongly enough to base most of the cryptography that they use on this scheme. So let me just say, you know, security relies on the assumption that factoring is hard. So certainly, you know, someone could come along tomorrow, you know, one of you could, you know, be thinking about factoring this afternoon, and maybe tomorrow you think of some algorithm, some classical algorithm, which will factor numbers in polynomial time on a classical computer. And then, well, you should think carefully about, you know, the way in which you should reveal your algorithm. But then certainly we would have to stop using RSA, and that's a logical possibility that could happen. But maybe it seems unlikely. But on the other hand, you know, before people thought about quantum computers, it probably seemed unlikely that we would come up with any kind of natural model of computation in which we could do factoring in polynomial time. But it turns out with quantum computers we can. And this was, you know, this was a big surprise when Shor discovered it in 1994. Okay, so that's the next thing we're going to see, is how this Shor's algorithm works. All right, yes. Yes, right. So so at least it's thought that problem is hard, right? So if you're given some integer n, which is a product of two primes, and you want to compute its Euler-Totient function, that had better be hard. Because if we could do that, then we could break the scheme. And I think actually you can prove that that's, you can prove that that's as hard as factoring. Because of, you know, this thing that I said, that you know, even to recover the private key, you know, that's as hard as factoring. And certainly if you could compute the Totient function, you could recover the private key. Yeah, so that's actually as hard as factoring.
It's actually like, since the Totient function is p
Yeah, okay. So yeah, it's straightforward.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is exactly equivalent. Yeah.
Okay, good. Okay, good. Other questions? Okay. So how is Shor's algorithm going to work? So what we're going to do is we're going to think about this as a problem actually not directly for factoring, but for a related problem, which is called order finding. And then if we have time, which we probably won't, we may discuss the relationship between order finding and factoring. There's a simple reduction that says that if you can solve the order finding problem, then you can solve the factoring problem. And you know, this was actually something which was known long before Shor's algorithm. So there was result of Miller in the 1970s that showed that if you could solve order finding, you could solve factoring. So this was actually known for a long time. And what Shor actually did was to come up with an algorithm for the order finding. So this is based on a reduction to order finding. And what is the order finding problem? So given some number A, so this should be some, you know, I guess positive integer, the order of A mod n is the smallest positive integer r such that A to the r is congruent to 1 mod n. Okay, so is the smallest positive integer r such that A to the r is 1 modulo n. So, okay, so just to kind of check that everyone is following, so let's do an example. So suppose n is 15 and A is 2. So what's the order of A modulo n? I think I heard someone say it softly. Four. Yes, it's 4. Exactly. Right. So why is it 4? Of course, you know, order finding is a hard problem, but this is a small instance, so you can just kind of try all the cases, right? So 2 to the 1 is 2. You know, modulo 15. So that's not going to be it. So 2 to the 2 is equal to 4. Well, that's not 1 modulo 15. 2 to the 3 is equal to 8. So that, you know, if we reduce it mod 15 is 8. So that's still not it. But if we raise 2 to the power 4, that's 16. And that's the same thing as 1 modulo 15, right? Because 16 minus 1 is a multiple of 15. It is 15. OK, so in this case, the order of A modulo n is 4. OK, good. OK, so the order finding problem is simply, you know, the problem that you're given A and n, and you would like to compute the order of A modulo n. So this is what we would like to do. And as I said, there's a reduction from factoring to order finding. So the reduction basically will involve, you know, picking a random, so n will be just the number we want to factor. We'll pick a random A modulo n that's coprime to n, and then we'll solve the order finding problem. And from that, you can actually, much of the time, so you've picked a random A, but for many random A's, actually this will allow you to find a factor. So if we have time, maybe we'll talk about this some more, but we may not have too much time to talk about you know, directly about the relationship between factoring and order finding. But for now, just you know, take my word for it that if we had an algorithm for this order finding problem, then we have an algorithm for factoring. Okay, let me remember what I wanted to say next. Right, okay. So we want to come up with an algorithm for doing this. And this algorithm is going to be, so a quantum algorithm, and this algorithm is going to be based on phase estimation. So this is actually not the way that Shor originally stated his algorithm, but it's another way of thinking about the algorithm that's, I mean, it's really going to be the same algorithm. It's going to be, you're going to give us exactly the same quantum circuit. And it's another way of thinking about it that I think is, you know, is fairly intuitive and uses this nice tool of phase estimation. So this is the way it's often presented nowadays. So the strategy will be to perform phase estimation on some unitary operator. And so now let me say what that unitary operator will be. It will be this thing that I'll call the multiplication by A map. So we're given some A, and we would like to We would like to come up with a unitary operator that depends on A in some way that's going to allow us to, you know, to compute the order of A modulo N. And the unitary will be exactly the following. So consider the multiplication by A map. So it's the following. So it's going to be some unitary operator U. I mean, it's actually just going to be a permutation. It's just going to be a classical computation. And what it does on some input state x is it just multiplies by A modulo n. So this is going to be A times x reduced modulo n. Okay. So you know, one thing to see is that that this actually makes sense, that this is actually an invertible transformation. And actually, to ensure that it's an invertible transformation, you need one other condition, which actually needs even for the, we need even for the order to be defined, which is that A should be coprime to n. Okay, so this is unitary, provided, I mean, it's actually just because it's a you know, there's a bijection between the values x and the values A times x mod n, provided A and n are relatively prime. So the GCD of A and n is one, so they have no common factors. And you know, this is anyway a necessary condition for the order to be defined, because if A and N are not relatively prime, if they have some common factors, then you can see that actually there will be no R such that A to the R is equal to 1 mod N. So the order won't even be defined. Okay, so this is actually necessary for the order to exist. So we'll actually only be interested in values of A that satisfy this condition, that they share no common factors with N. OK, so this is a unitary operation. And so the idea will be, you know, we want to do phase estimation on this unitary operation. So remember, phase estimation has something to do with the eigenvectors and the eigenvalues of a unitary. It allows us to estimate the eigenvalue corresponding to a particular eigenvector. So what we should do is we should, you know, we should try to somehow understand what the eigenvalues and eigenvectors of U are. Okay, so how can we do that? Well, to do that, I first want to sort of think about a simpler operator. And if we understand its eigenvalues and eigenvectors, it'll be easy to understand these. So let's here consider a related operator. So let's consider the operator P that just adds 1 modulo R. So P acting on some value x, well, now x will be a value modulo R for some R, which will be exactly the order, instead of a value modulo n. So P acting on x will be x plus 1 modulo R. So this is the plus 1 operator. So this is just, you know, if you want to think about this as an R by R matrix, it's just the matrix that has ones on the upper diagonal and in the lower left corner. Or maybe it's the lower diagonal and the upper right corner. I can never get these things straight in my head, but it's one of the two. Okay, so this is some unitary matrix. It's actually a permutation matrix, just like this one is. And we would like to understand what its eigenvectors and eigenvalues are. So can somebody tell me how I can find the eigenvectors of this operator? Can use a principle from physics. So I mean, this has to do with sort of symmetry, right? So this thing actually, you know, commutes with, you know, this is translation by one. So this thing, you know, this operator is going to be some, you know, translation symmetric thing. And so the, you know, the basis it's in which it's diagonal should be the basis that diagonalizes translation invariant things, and that basis is exactly the Fourier basis, right? So okay, well, the other thing we can do is we can just write down the eigenvectors and we can check, right? So so the eigenvectors are the Fourier basis states, so the Fourier basis states where the modulus is R. So before we looked at this where R was a power of 2, but there's kind of an obvious generalization of the Fourier transform that we saw before to the case where the modulus is not necessarily a power of 2. So the eigenvectors are the Fourier vectors. And what are those vectors? Well, let me write them as, you know, maybe k-twiddle. And what is k-twiddle? So k-twiddle is 1 over the square root of r times the sum. X goes from 0 to r minus 1 of e to the 2 pi I k over r k. And actually, maybe I want to put a minus sign in there. I forget. I just want to remember which is the convention that, of course, it's right either way, but I want to remember which is the convention that makes things nice. OK, I guess I did it just like this. OK. Oh, right. If we do it like this, then there's a minus sign in the eigenvalue. So the thing that you can see is that this is an eigenvector of p. With eigenvalue e to the minus 2 pi I k over r. Oh, sorry. And this doesn't make any sense, right? So this should be kx over r, and this should be x. Does this look OK now? So these are just the Fourier basis vectors. I mean, these are the generalization of the Fourier basis vectors that we saw before when r happened to be a power of 2. So we just have these phases that go like, you know, so there's some multiplier of k, which is the thing that labels the vector and the exponent. That gets multiplied by x, which is the particular basis state that we're considering. So this is the amplitude in front of that basis state, well, with this divided by 1 over the square root of r. And what you can see, if you multiply this thing by p, is that you'll get an eigenvalue, which is exactly e to the minus 2 pi I k over r. You know, the way you see that is basically just to reindex the sum. Because if you multiply, you know, you act with p on this state, x gets replaced by x plus 1 here. Well, if you want to make the thing look the same, you just replace x by x minus 1. So x gets replaced by x minus 1 up here. And then you have a global factor of e to the minus 2 pi I k over r that pulls out front, right? So that's how you see that this thing is the eigenvalue corresponding to this eigenstate. OK, and this is actually, you know, so we could consider any value of k modulo r. So this actually gives us all the eigenvectors of the operator. OK. So now, given this thing, how can we understand the eigenvectors of u? So now we understand the eigenvalues and the eigenvectors of p. So how do we understand the eigenvectors and the eigenvalues of u? Well, there's a bijection between the values modulo r and the values modulo n that we get by, you know, taking a and raising it to some power. Modulo n, right? So so there is a bijection where if I take the value, you know, a to the, a to the x modulo n, so this is in bijection with, you know, the value x modulo r. Why is that? Well, you know, I mean, not only do these two sets have the same size, but there's a bijection that kind of respects the algebraic structure, so which is additive here and multiplicative here. Because if I multiply, you know, if I add some multiple of r to x, well, then things are going to come back around. So r here is the, you know, is the order of a modulo n, right? If I take a to the x plus r and I compute the value modulo n. Well, a to the r is equal to 1 modulo n. So this is the same thing as a to the x times 1 modulo n. So this is the same thing as a to the x modulo n. So it's this wrapping around again that we were talking about before. Things wrap around if I multiply by a to the r over here, which corresponds to adding r over here. Right? So I have some bijection between the values a to the x mod n here and the value x mod r over here. And so that immediately lets me come up with, well, at least r of the eigenvectors of this unitary operator just by applying this bijection to figure out what the state should be. Right? So there are r eigenvectors of u obtained as follows. So I'm going to call these things psi sub k. And psi sub k is just the thing that I get by applying this bijection. So this is just 1 over the square root of r times the sum x equals 0 to r minus 1, e to the 2 pi I kx over r times now a to the x, which I think of as a value mod n, because I'm writing down an eigenvector of u instead of an eigenvector of p. So it should live in some space that's spanned by n basis states instead of just r. OK, so this is an eigenvector of u. And what is its eigenvalue? Well, you know, u acts to multiply by a, which is the same thing. You know, if I multiply by a mod n, then under this bijection, that's the same thing as adding 1 modulo r. That's what this operator p did. And so the eigenvalues are exactly the same, right? I mean, the action of this thing is really, you know, under this isomorphism, u is just behaving exactly like p. So the eigenvalues must be the same. So the eigenvalues are, you know, the same. So e to the minus 2 pi I k over r. Now, there must be some other eigenvectors of u with some other eigenvalues, because u is a bigger matrix. But we're actually not going to care about any of the other eigenvectors, because they won't be relevant to the algorithm. So now we actually know everything we need to know about the spectrum of u. OK. So now, what is this going to have to do with the algorithm for order finding? How are we going to get some information out about the order? Well, now what you see is that the eigenvalues have some information in them about r. Right? So if I could make some eigenvector of u, and then I could estimate its eigenvalue, that would be great, because that would tell me what r is. I mean, at least if I could exactly compute the eigenvalue, which maybe is a problem, because in phase estimation, I only get an estimate. But at least if I could exactly compute the eigenvalue, then that would have some information in it about r, because r is just the denominator of, you know, the phase. Right? So that sounds great. So let's think about that as our strategy. So let's apply phase estimation to the unitary u on the state, well, say on one of these states, psi sub k, for some k. OK, now in order to do this, certainly we need to be able to apply the unitary operator u. So that needs to be something we can do efficiently. And in fact, to do phase estimation, remember, we have to apply very high powers of u. So that's, you know, something to maybe be a little bit worried about. But it turns out that it's that's something that's really not hard to do. So let's just think briefly about how we would actually implement u on a quantum computer. Notice that this is not the way we normally think about computing a function. We're not just computing a times x in another register. We're actually replacing x with a times x. So we're not keeping around the input the way we normally do when we think about reversible computation. So we have to think maybe just briefly about how we can actually do this. OK, so implementing u. OK, well, certainly what we can do is we can write the value a times x in another register. So we could have something where we have x and then some ancilla register in the 0 state. And then we could write a times x mod n in the other register. So that's no problem. And then, well, we really want a times x to be in the first register. So we can swap these two registers. So this is a times x mod n x. I mean, certainly swapping the two registers is something unitary. But now we would like to get rid of this x, right? Because we really just wanted to map x to a times x. OK, but remember, this is some a-dependent operation. We know what a is. A is just classical information. So to compute x from a times x is just division. And we know how to do division efficiently also on a classical computer, so we can do it efficiently, you know, in a reversible way on a quantum computer. So just by reversible division, we can compute what x is. And so by doing that backwards, we can actually uncompute this x. So here we can just get a times x mod n and reset this other register to 0. Did you have a question?
I'm sorry, would you
mind explaining that? Oh, yeah, sure. I'll try. There's a lot to do, but please remind me if I speed up again. Yes. No. I mean, I appreciate the suggestion. Okay. So what we're trying to do here. Let me just recap. So we're trying to compute the map that sends x to a times x mod n. The way we do that is to compute a times x mod n in another register, put that in the place where we really want it, and then uncompute the thing that we originally had. And these all correspond to operations that we can do efficiently. And so this is some transformation that we can actually perform efficiently. Now, we don't just want to do U, we also want to be able to do very high powers of U. So we also want to do U to the 2 to the k for potentially very large k, and we would like to be able to do this in time polynomial in k and, well, also in the log of n, which is the number of bits in these registers that we're working with. And it turns out that this is something that we can do. There's a trick for doing this, which is basically to use repeated squaring. I mean, it's the same trick that we would use, you know, that Alice would use in her computation of, you know, when she's doing the key generation for RSA. So remember, you know, she had to, it's the same trick that they would use in the encryption and the decryption phase. So for example, when Bob wants to compute m to the e modulo n, you know, that's potentially a very large number. E could be some exponentially large power, you know, exponentially large in the log of n. But that's fine because you can easily compute very high powers by repeated squaring, always reducing the value modulo n so you never have to work with numbers that are too big. So, you know, the take-home message is that there's some trick that allows you to do this. Okay, so this can be done by repeated squaring. So whereas in general, it can be hard to compute, to apply very high powers of unitary operator, in this case, we actually can do it efficiently. Okay, so that's great. So that says, as far as the unitary is concerned, we actually can perform, we can think about performing phase estimation efficiently. Right? So we could perform phase estimation efficiently for the unitary U on any given state. Okay, but now there's maybe another problem. So can you see sort of what the problem is? So how would we apply the unitary U on one of these states psi sub k? So for example, you know, maybe we want to apply this on the state psi sub 1. Right? So that would be this state with the value k equals 1. Can we actually make that state? Like how would we try to make that state? It's a superposition over R terms. Remember what R is, right? R is the order of A modulo N. That's exactly the thing we want to compute. Right? So we don't know what R is. So we have these phases that depend in some way on R. R is exactly the thing we're trying to determine. So, you know, how would we make the state? I mean, it's some state which depends on R, and R is exactly the thing that we would like to extract. So this is a problem. And in fact, there are more problems than this. So there are kind of three problems. Let me mention them now. So first of all, we don't know R. So we can't make a particular psi k. So already, you know, we can't make the state that we want to make. But suppose somehow we could get around this problem and we could make that state. Well, actually, there are other problems. Some of these other problems I alluded to first. So the next thing is that, you know, when we do phase estimation, we don't actually learn the value k over r. In general, we just get an estimate of the value k over r. Right, so we're only going to get an estimate. And so now somehow from an estimate of k over r, we want to learn what the denominator r is. But we're not given the value exactly. We're just given some approximation. So this is like somebody gives you some, you know, maybe like decimal expansion of some number that is close to a rational number, and you want to know what the denominator is. How do you do that? Okay, so that's something else you have to do. And then there's even still one more problem, which is, you know, suppose you could actually figure out what the fraction k over r was. What if k and r have common factors? Right, if k and r have common factors, then we might, instead of learning the value r, we might get the value r over 2 or r over 3 or, you know, some other number which is not r, but it's, you know, r divided by something. Right? R can be composite. Certainly r can be composite in general, so we could get r divided by some integer. So this is the third problem. K and R could have common factors. So it's looking bleak, right? I mean, there are all these problems, but it turns out that we can get around all of these problems. Okay, so how are we going to get around the first problem that we're not actually able to create this state for any given psi k? Well, actually, we don't have to be able to do this for any particular psi k necessarily. We could think about doing some kind of procedure where we don't feed in an eigenstate, but we feed in a superposition of eigenstates. And then we do phase estimation in superposition. And then what we'll get will be, you know, we'll get a result corresponding to one of the eigenvalues with a probability that goes like the amplitude squared for that particular eigenstate in the superposition that we had. Right. So what maybe you might think about doing is instead of taking one particular psi k, actually take the superposition of all the psi k's. That maybe that's the simplest kind of superposition you could think about, and it turns out that that works. So let's think about how we can solve all these problems in turn. And for the first one, we're going to do phase estimation in superposition. Okay, so what's the superposition we're going to do phase estimation on? We're going to consider the uniform superposition of all the psi k's. So remember that there are r different psi k's because, you know, these things were isomorphic to these things. Here there were really r values of k modulo r that we could take, and we're using exactly the same values here to label these states. I mean, this k is really exactly the same as this k. So this k is really some number modulo r. So let's consider the uniform superposition of all of those states. So that would be 1 over the square root of r, the sum over k going from 0 to r minus 1, psi sub k. All right, so let's see what that state looks like. So I claim that that state actually doesn't depend on r. So although the psi k's individually depend on r, this state does not. And it turns out that it's something pretty simple. So let's just do the computation. So I have two factors of 1 over the square root of r, so that gives me a 1 over r. And now here I have a sum over k, and there I have a sum over x. So I have a sum over k and x from 0 to r minus 1. And then I have a phase of e to the 2 pi I x over r. E to the 2 pi I k x over r. And then that's the coefficient of a to the x, right? So this is a to the x. Modulo n, but I guess I'm dropping the mod n because, you know, this register always stores something which is modulo n. Okay, so now what can I say about this state? Well, this is a kind of sum that we've seen before. So, you know, what happens if I consider the x equals 0 term? Right, what do I get for this sum? So I plug in x equals 0. Right, this sum would be r. If I just do the sum over k, then I have a 1 over r, so I actually get 1. So that says there's going to be some term that just looks like a to the 0. Well, that's just 1, because if I raise anything to the 0, I get 1. And then, well, it has to be that the other terms all sum to 0, right? Because now I've got a state with norm 1, and so it must be, you know, I've already taken up the, you know, all the amplitude that I have available to me. So it can't be that there's anything left in the other states. And actually, it's easy to see that if you do the sum, so if you take any value of x which is different from 0, and you do the sum over k, you get 0, because you have a bunch of points equally spaced on the unit circle on the complex plane. And when you sum over all of those points, you get 0, because you just get 0. If you sum over a set of equally spaced points on the unit circle on the complex plane, everything cancels. The phases all cancel, and you get 0. So this is actually the whole state, a to the 0, or in other words, the state that just has the value 1 modulo n. Well, that's great, because that doesn't depend on r, right? So this is independent of r. So that's a state we could actually make. So this now will be the strategy. So we're going to kind of forget about this idea of doing it on, you know, psi sub k for some k. And instead, we're just going to do it on the state 1, which happens to be the uniform superposition over all the psi sub k's. And so now we just have to think about what happens if we do phase estimation in superposition, right? So what does phase estimation actually do? Well, we have some register that, you know, we initialize to zero that's supposed to, at the end of the day, store the estimated phase. And then we have another register which stores our eigenstate, but now it actually stores the superposition of eigenstates. So this is 1 over the square root of r times the sum where k goes from 0 to r minus 1 psi sub k. So this is the state that we said we would use. I mean, this is just the state 1, but this is the you know, way to write it to think about how phase estimation operates. Because remember, we know what happens if we feed in any particular eigenstate here. And phase estimation is implementing some linear transformation. So now if I do phase estimation, what I'm going to get will be, well, I mean, let me put quotes around this because I don't get exactly this. But so what I get is you know, a superposition over all of the values of k of some kind of an estimate of the phase. So the phase is, you know, e to the minus 2 pi I k over r. And, you know, I just get some estimate of that. So maybe let me write a, you know, twiddle over that to indicate that I'm just getting some kind of an approximation. I guess I used a twiddle before to mean the Fourier transform. Let me put quotes around that to mean that I just get some estimate. Okay. Then psi sub k. So I'm just doing phase estimation and superposition. So, you know, for the branch of the wave function associated with some particular eigenstate psi sub k, what I get is an estimate of e to the minus 2 pi I k over r. Now, you know, I have the quotes here because I'm actually just getting an approximation, and I only even get a good approximation with some constant probability. So there's also some piece of the state in which you don't even get a good approximation, but that piece is small. So that's the reason for the quotes. But so, you know, what will happen if you perform this phase estimation procedure and then you measure the contents of the register that store the estimated phase is that you will get an estimate of, let's say, k over r. I mean, we could think about this thing as just estimating the piece of the phase that's the k over r here. You get an estimate of k over r that is, so at least with constant probability, a good estimate of k over r. If you use if you use a lot of bits, if you use m bits to store the estimated phase, with constant probability, you get the best m bit approximation to k over r. And now you get this for a random k, and it's for a uniformly random k, because the amplitude for every one of the k's is the same. They all have amplitude 1 over the square root of r. So this gives, so with constant probability, a good estimate of k over r for a uniformly random k. Okay, so we got around the first problem. But now we have two more problems. There are some details that come into how you deal with these problems, but at least to say, you know, what you do at a high level is not too hard. So the next thing was that we only get some approximation of k over r, and somehow we want to infer what the denominator is from this approximation. Question?
You say a uniform random k, that sounds to me like k is distributed according to some probability distribution.
Right.
And we're not sure what the value of k is.
Exactly.
So that how does that help us get off if we're not sure what the value of k is?
Right. Well, so what we know is that we have a good approximation to a fraction whose denominator is r. So if it were the case that and we don't know what k is, so we don't know what the numerator is. But if it were the case, I mean, if we had an exact specification of k over r, and if k and r were not relatively prime, so in other words, if we didn't have these problems 2 or 3, you know, then we could just read out the denominator, and that would be the answer. And we would actually also learn what k is, but, I mean, we don't actually really care which k we got, because that was just some random thing. But, you know, in particular, we could infer what the denominator is.
Wait, I thought that if we had the output is more or less k over r.
Right.
That's right.
So
if we have k over r and we don't know what k is, how do we extract r?
Well, if, you know, so if K and R are relatively prime, so they have no common factors, and, you know, we have an exact expression for K over R, you just figure out how to write that, you know, maybe it's given to you as a decimal number, but you just figure out how to write that as a fraction in lowest terms. You know, and then the denominator would just be R. But, I mean, you know, it's cheating when I say that because there are these other two problems, but, you know, that's what we're going to talk about next. And I'm going to try to just kind of summarize this quickly because I do realize we're out of time. Okay, so this second problem has to do with the fact that we only get an estimate. And it turns out that there's a tool, which is a completely classical tool, which is designed for exactly figuring out this kind of thing, which is this thing called the continued fraction expansion. So the continued fraction expansion of some number, which you know, in general could even be an irrational number. Of course, the estimate that we get here will always be a rational number, but possibly with you know, a denominator that kind of over approximates k over r. So anyway, the continued fraction expansion of some arbitrary real number is the following. So you know, we have some number, let's say x, and you can write that as the form, well, some integer, you know, a0 plus 1 over a1 plus 1 over a2 plus dot, dot, dot. Right? So this is called a continued fraction. And, you know, it turns out that there are algorithms for computing part of the continued fraction expansion. I mean, of course, if you have an irrational number, the continued fraction would extend forever. So these a's, by the way, are integers, right? So I can you know, compute some integers here that give me the continued fraction expansion of the number. And if I want to compute some finite number of terms in the continued fraction expansion, I can do that efficiently. And what I can do is I can imagine actually terminating the continued fraction expansion. And that gives me something that's called a convergent of the expansion. And that would be some kind of a good rational approximation to this value x, even though the value x could potentially be irrational. So what you can prove is that if you take a good enough approximation, so if you use enough bits in your phase estimation, and then you take the continued fraction expansion of this value k over r, this approximation of k over r that comes out of the phase estimation, then with constant probability, r will actually appear as the denominator of one of these convergents of the continued fraction expansion. So I don't know, there are far too many details here to actually, you know, explain in depth how you do these calculations and, you know, prove that this is the case. But let me just say, you know, it can be shown, so claim, with enough bits of precision in phase estimation, R will appear as the denominator of some convergent. Of the continued fraction expansion. And alas, I mean, if you want to understand this in more depth, well, you could ask me a bit about it after the lecture. And then, you know, probably what you would really have to do to understand it well would be to read about kind of the theory of these continued fractions. But this is a completely classical thing that we do as the post-processing of Shor's algorithm. And so the final thing to worry about is this fact that K and R could have common factors. And so what you can show here is that actually if you pick K uniformly at random, actually the probability that K and R have any common factors is not too big. So with K uniformly random, so it's reasonably likely. So reasonably likely means you only have to repeat things a polynomial number of times before you get a good situation. So it's reasonably likely that K and R do not have common factors. And this is just because, well, if I pick, you know, say I pick numbers, you know, uniformly at random between 1 and n minus 1, And I want to think about what's the probability that they're co-prime to n, so that they don't share any common factors with n. Well, the probability goes like, you know, at worst, like 1 over log log n. So this is some other kind of fact from number theory you would need to prove. But the upshot of this is that if you do this whole procedure, you know, some of the time, you may be doing the phase estimation for a bad k. I mean, the k that corresponds to the measurement outcome that you see when you actually do this phase estimation in superposition may be a bad one. But if that's the case, just repeat the whole thing. And there are many steps in the algorithm where, you know, we can sort of only say that things work with constant probability. But that's fine, because if the whole thing works with constant probability, we just repeat the whole algorithm a constant number of times. And the result will be you know, that eventually, after some constant number of repetitions, we'll get the right answer. And of course, because factoring is an NP problem, once we find a factor, we know that we're right, because we can easily check the answer ourselves just by multiplication. And so it suffices to have some procedure which overall just works with constant probability. Okay, so you know, the other ingredient that I didn't really explain in any detail at all is, you know, this relationship between factoring and order finding, right? So what we actually saw here was an algorithm for the order finding problem, and what we really wanted was an algorithm for the factoring problem. So I guess we're probably not going to have time to talk about this, but if you want to read about the relationship between factoring and order finding, well, for example, the Nielsen and Chuang textbook has a nice explanation of this in one of the appendices, and it's also something that we could talk about, you know, one-on-one if you have questions about it. Okay, so I think I'd better stop there, but maybe I should just give you one last chance to ask questions. Yes?
So when you do the algorithm with a k that's actually not valid, what does the algorithm spit out?
Who knows? Who knows? We don't care. I mean, it always gives us some, you know, bit string.
So it just gives you some bit string, but then when you check it, does the NP turn out to be wrong?
Yeah, I mean, the phase estimation gives you some bit string. Then you compute a bunch of, you know, then you compute a bunch of convergence of the continued fraction expansion. I mean, you do a lot of work. And then at the end of the day, you realize, hey, none of those things gave me the right answer. You had to check them all. None of them gave you the right answer. So you think, huh, OK, something must have gone wrong along the way. I'm going to try again.
OK, so you just end up wasting a bunch of time and getting a bad answer.
Yes, but you only end up wasting polynomially large amount of time. And that's the joys of complexity theory and not having to worry about kind of you know, the practicalities of you know, really trying to optimize the algorithm. Now, people sort of have thought about these kinds of issues, because of course, if you want to try to implement the algorithm in practice, you know, you should think about how to do as little work as possible. But that's another lecture. Yes.
Just a quick question. So why is this actually interesting practically? I mean, surely if you can even build a quantum computer, people would just not use RSA. Right?
Well, right. So maybe they wouldn't use RSA, but so then you have to ask, well, what else would they use? You know, so another leading candidate is what's called elliptic curve cryptography, which is based on the idea that a certain problem called the discrete log problem for elliptic curves is hard. So actually in the same paper where Shor showed that you could factor, he also showed that you can compute discrete logs efficiently. He wasn't talking explicitly about elliptic curves, but the same algorithm works even for these elliptic curves. So actually, you know, these similar kinds of ideas actually break a lot of cryptography. Basically, most of the cryptography that's used in practice is actually broken by similar ideas. There are other proposals, though, for cryptosystems that we don't know how to break using quantum computers. So, you know, maybe you can come up with some other scheme that's okay, and then I think it's a legitimate question, you know, what you're asking, you know, why would we actually use this? Then people would just find some other cryptosystem to use. So from a practical standpoint, I think that's true. Unless you know, just have some numbers you want to factor, the algorithm is not actually something you would want to do. You know, of course, I think it's also interesting that there is this algorithm from a kind of a basic, you know, fundamental, you know, perspective. It's an example of something that we can do fast with quantum computers that we don't know how to do with classical computers. But in terms of like applications, the main one is really to break in cryptosystems. And if people just decide to use other cryptosystems, then that's not really a good application. But I mean, another thing that I could say, just very briefly, is that people have used RSA for a long time, and there are things, you know, secret messages lying around that have been encrypted with RSA. So even if people decided to switch from RSA to, say, lattice-based cryptography today, they could still, you know, have a field day decrypting old messages, and there's probably good stuff in there. I mean, yeah. So we might still want to do it even if people switch to other crypto systems. Okay, we probably better stop there, but see you tomorrow.